A recent ABC headline declared that 18,000 police and 1,800 soldiers are now patrolling the streets of Sydney to enforce COVID-related restrictions. And that activity is heavily focused on the western and southwestern suburbs, such as Fairfield. Fully half of Fairfield's population was born overseas into non-English-speaking countries, and large numbers of residents come from countries like Vietnam, Iraq, and Cambodia. And these are the workers doing the essential jobs that keep Sydney running, usually poorly paid, often in casual roles and with no access to sick leave to get vaccinated, even if vaccinations are available. These working class families have no reason to trust the government and the police. To them, police on the streets doesn't look like a safety measure, but more like repression. Today, I'm talking to two people about alternatives to this situation, alternatives that start with public health measures, not enforcement. Vicky Sentas is a senior lecturer in law at the University of New South Wales. She recently wrote on the subject of COVID and policing on the website The Conversation with her colleagues Professor Leanne Webber and senior lecturer Louise Boon Kuo. And Cooper Forsyth is a casual worker at the Annette Kellerman Pool in the Sydney suburb of Enmore, a member of the United Workers Union and of Solidarity. And he recently helped organise a car convoy calling for adequate income support payments and improved safety at work. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity, a revolutionary socialist group in Australia. If you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Naarm, or Melbourne. So, Vicky, welcome.
Hi, David. Great to be speaking with you.
Now, you wrote your article with your colleagues at the end of July at a time when an extra 100 police, including mounted police, were being deployed into southwest Sydney. Now, obviously, those numbers have grown substantially. Is this going to be effective in stopping the spread of the pandemic?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. And I guess, you know, we know that it's the vaccination of the majority of the population, and we know that it's real social and economic support for those who need it, but that's the only real way to stop the spread of COVID. But I guess we've seen in the absence of government action on getting vaccines precisely when it was first needed to happen to make containment viable, we've needed to rely on lockdowns. Now, I would say it's not inevitable to take a law and order and a paramilitary, well, in fact, not just a paramilitary approach, but now an outright military approach with the ADF on the streets in New South Wales. But that's what the states are relying on in their approach to lockdowns. And that's a strategy of more police on the streets. And that relies on coercive enforcement, deterrence and punishment strategy. And so I guess, you know, it relies on this myth that, you know, knowing the cops will enforce the letter of the law and give you now a $5,000 fine, that's pretty hefty, it was a $1,000 fine in New South Wales, that you'll be deterred from breaching the orders. And so emerging kind of research, particularly from overseas, from kind of public health perspective, say, look, that's just not how it works. That doesn't tap into the collectivist community-minded approach around why people comply with lockdowns. And so it's based on this erroneous idea that highly visible policing strategies will scare people into compliance. Now, this is what we call a criminalisation approach. It's the furthest thing from a public health strategy. And it does have dire consequences on marginalised people, and not least through a greater risk of just getting caught up in the criminal justice system. And I think the reality is, if you look at what's going on at the moment, is that policing as a frontline approach to COVID hasn't actually worked. So enforcement statistics, police statistics around fines and other measures are going up, and the numbers of police are going up, but at the same time, the number of infections are going up, not down in New South Wales. So just even as a matter of common sense, the policing approach isn't working. And also policing just can't address the causes of transmission, whether it's because people need to go to work. and they're not being adequately compensated with a safety net for lost wages, or, you know, where transmission is happening because of people's social or cultural and economic needs kind of are dependent on collective ties, and there hasn't been adequate understanding of supporting people in lockdown to be safe.
You mentioned that vulnerable people are dragged sometimes further or for the first time into the clutches of the criminal justice system. There are many people living in these suburbs who have come here as refugees or have experienced repression overseas. What is the policing actually like in these suburbs, and how are the vulnerable being dragged in? I mean, for instance, we know in Victoria last year, 5% of all COVID-related fines were given to Indigenous people, even though they make up less than 1% of the state's population, and 4% of the fines went to people born in Sudan or South Sudan, and they make up 0.05% of the population. So how's it playing out in Western and Southwestern Sydney?
Well, that's exactly right, David. It is people of colour, First Nations people, who've always been over-policed, who continue to be over-policed during COVID. So you mentioned fines, and on-the-spot fines have definitely been a key feature and a key driver of COVID policing. And fines are, of course, deeply punitive for those who can't pay. And they are, you know, by design, designed to target working class and precarious people. And when you put race in that mix, it amplifies, I guess, some of the older kind of invisibilized policing strategies that target racialized minority communities. And I remember there was some great research done last year by Osman Faruqi, the journalist, that showed that in New South Wales, the distribution of fines by police fell disproportionately on people in southwest Sydney, which is, of course, a higher kind of population of migrant communities, migrant background communities, compared to much lower fines in higher socioeconomic areas. But at that time last year, there were far more infections. So it kind of blows out of the water, this idea, this myth that there's a relationship between policing and infection rates, which is, you know, certainly not at all true. But as well as fines, I mean, some research I did with my colleagues, one of the more interesting practices that came up in some New South Wales police data we got through FOI processes, and this is, you know, from last year again and for like a 3-month period. So it's small and it's incomplete, but it showed that the police, in the name of COVID policing, were really over-relying on stop and search. And we sort of found that once a person is stopped for a suspected COVID breach, we saw about 45% of all of those police encounters ended in a search. Now, that just seems crazy to me, but if you think about it in terms of normal over-policing, it kind of makes sense. So with that data, First Nations were, of course, overrepresented compared to the general population. And so they were overrepresented around searches. They made up about 10% of all people searched, but also police have an arrest power. I mean, they've been focusing more on fines rather than arrests, but even still with those arrested in relation to COVID, First Nations made up about 15% of arrests. And if we look at just the numbers of First Nations people, full stop, recorded for having been stopped for COVID reasons, about 75% of all First Nations people who were stopped by police for a suspected COVID breach were then went on to be searched by police. And it was lower for non-Indigenous people, around 62-63%. So to me, that really speaks to the repressive functions of policing that are a kind of a normal part of policing. So the question that raises for me is, you know, why are people being searched after COVID stops? Is COVID being used as a pretext for targeting people that the police just see as the usual suspects? You know, and how many of these searches kind of resulted for, you know, non-COVID offences? Was it a case where police encountered, say, you know, young people and went, oh, you look a bit dodgy, we're going to search you because we think you've got drugs on you or whatever? So I think, you know, we need to interrogate what's going on there. And if we think about it in terms of policing generally, I mean, we know that the vast majority of stop and searches in non-COVID contexts normally result in nothing being found. So the rates are really high. I think, you know, it's only in about 6% of all stop and searches that something illegal that might have legally justified the search is normally found. And that's because police either don't understand or don't actually care about the legal limits on their powers. And search people as a show of force and an exercise of their power to intimidate people. And I think the same thing's going on with stop and search in COVID. It's sending signals about who are the targets of policing, and it's an exercise of police authority. So in this way, COVID policing to me is actually just old-fashioned colonial and racialized street policing.
And presumably is a health risk in and of itself. If you're surrounded by two or three police officers at close quarters and told to turn out your pockets or whatever, you are certainly not socially distancing. So, and police are presumably moving across Sydney. So there's actually a health risk as well as an element of racism and harassment involved.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's a really good way of understanding policing as a health risk, you know, certainly in COVID times, but understanding policing as a health risk, you know, more broadly. I mean, yeah, at an obvious level, searching people kind of very much unnecessarily increases the risk of transmission. And that's a really obvious way that we can see the clash between public health objectives and the criminalisation approach to policing. And I remember with the, you know, the first wave of COVID police were not wearing masks at all. I mean, I think that's changed now. And at the time, there was a coalition of community groups, community legal centres, led by Flemington Kensington Legal Centre in Victoria. And they were collecting reports from people last year of their experiences of policing. And I remember reading some of those reports. There were stories of police unmasked in very close proximity to people who had, you know, health issues, who were asking for safe distance from the police. And, you know, police were interpreting this as a lack of deference to their authority or seeing it as aggressive, and that escalating the situation unnecessarily. So yeah, at a really kind of basic level, policing itself can be a health risk.
And there's another aspect that strikes me, and that's around the question of fines. I know in Victoria, the majority of fines from last year are still unpaid. And despite their so-called progressive reputation, self-description, the Victorian government has declared that all fines will be pursued. So that's potentially for individuals thousands of dollars. And we're talking about people who may well be on low wages or on benefits. At some point, are we looking at a pandemic after the pandemic, but the second pandemic being seizure of personal property, of cars or other goods of some of the most vulnerable people? How does that work out in practice?
Yeah, look, that's a really good point. And it is hugely worrying around the punitive and punishing effects of fines. And it's only been quite recently in this country, in different states, that we actually have stopped jailing people for fines, and very recently in Western Australia, where we saw the kind of most pernicious and devastating and tragic effects, the ultimate end of not being able to pay a fine, particularly if you're an Indigenous person, you know, can end up in jail as a kind of consequence of not paying a fine. And because of the advocacy work of groups like Sisters in Sign, that's only really very recently been changed. There were some reforms made in kind of Victoria and New South Wales some time ago to kind of put up more barriers to kind of finding yourself in jail after not being able to pay fines. So it's actually incredibly rare, if at all, now not really an occurrence. But you're absolutely right in terms of the effects of, the flow-on effects of not being able to pay your fines is huge in terms of people who are low income or don't have any incomes in particular. And that's something that we're going to have to keep a really close eye on, and hopefully there'll be a lot of advocacy and pushback and organising around that. And it is deeply concerning that governments are saying they're going to really pursue people around fines. It is part of that deterrence and punishing framework, you know, ultimately a form of revenue for the state that they're pursuing really recklessly. And I think it's going to have to be a watch this space to see, you know, it might be an opportunity for a fines amnesty campaign.
Now, you and your colleagues wrote in The Conversation that, and I'm quoting now your words, a community-focused public health approach would move away from coercive policing and emphasise co-developed community resources on COVID restrictions and their purpose. How would this approach work?
So I think in broad ways, there's two ways you can think about this. I mean, one line of thinking is to use police resources to do what is more talked about in the UK and some US states, is this concept of public health policing. It's not really a concept or a practice that's ever really taken off in Australia. And in many ways, the concept is very anathema to the, you know, the ongoing kind of colonial form of policing that we have. So a public health approach to policing is more about dropping the enforcement strategy around targeting and identifying risky individuals and targeting individuals who've technically breached the laws to more of a population-wide health view, focused on the police doing all the things that would support health workers, nurses and doctors to do the prevention work under the direction of health workers. So it's about diverting police resources to support dwindling public sector resources. Now, of course, we're a million miles away from that in any jurisdiction in Australia. And, you know, at a really almost tokenistic level, I guess a tangible example of that is, you know, in the early days of kind of COVID, the police in some jurisdictions, particularly the ACT, sort of said explicitly, we're not going to take an enforcement approach, we're going to take an education approach. And in some police area command in Victoria and New South Wales, like police getting involved in handing out kind of leaflets alongside public health workers, you know, in communities where, you know, translated kind of leaflets and things like that. So some might call that tokenistic. That's kind of one of the kind of more tangible, I guess, examples. The other way to think about it is, and it's, you know, we talked about it before, you know, if you frame police to be a risk to public health, not least through the way that policing, you know, is an abuse of power, you know, systematically. But we might also think of, you know, policing as not just not being the right skill set at all, and that even with a community policing approach or a public health approach, that police are part of the problem and that they actually need to vacate the space. And so this is kind of more in line with an abolitionist approach to, you know, what's often referred to as shrinking the footprint of policing, and another kind of route to reinvesting police funds to health agencies. So, you know, this might be seen as kind of, you know, utopian, and, you know, one of the first, I guess, small steps that can be taken is just taking more of an educative approach rather than an enforcement approach within policing. But it has to be more around not ceding power to police and the ADF, around setting the priorities, the strategic priorities, and, you know, the strategies on the ground around what public health looks like. It's about reinvesting the thinking, the strategic kind of resources and the money resources back into public health.
Now, many people are worried that some of the draconian controls that have been brought in the name of stopping the pandemic, and for instance, we're back under curfew in Melbourne, will stay in use even after mass vaccination reduces the health risk. Is that a concern that you share?
Look, I think it's really hard to tell what new powers will stay. And you mentioned curfews in Melbourne. I think having continued curfews in a more normal state of affairs is one of the kind of obvious political liabilities that, you know, would mobilise, you know, a huge affront to kind of, you know, ideas of liberal democracy. So I'm not sure. I mean, that seems like a political liability to continue with curfews, and that, you know, seen by most people as a hallmark of a police state. And I think the thing with COVID is that very few of the actual powers are actually new. So the new criminal offences are new, and the police get their power by enforcing the new criminal offences. But all of the powers, you know, apart from curfew, as you mentioned, are powers that they've already got now. And police already have pretty expansive powers given to them already. That was not given after decades and decades of law and order kind of auctions and law and order elections. So they've got everything that they need. So for me, it's more about how post-COVID those invisible kind of aspects of police power will get further entrenched. And one element of that, I think, is I suspect that there's going to be more enhanced police intelligence through all of the ongoing data sharing that was enabled and, you know, amplified through COVID. I think enhanced police intelligence is a real prospect. And also all the flow-on ways that that fortifies policing. So a real question might be, you know, in the next budget, what budget increases will be made to policing post-COVID? And also there's a really interesting political economy dimension to policing. And so, you know, in the last 15 years in this country, policing, police budgets have shifted more on rewarding and expanding police budgets. When police meet KPIs, key performance indicators, around numbers of stop and search, numbers of move on directions. And that's one of the reasons why we've got really hyper bloated kind of numbers of stop and search, and, you know, the differential effects on First Nations and migrant communities is because police are rewarded by meeting those KPIs. And so one, I think, really interesting question is, to what extent, with all of the increased enforcement statistics we're seeing during COVID, to what extent is that potentially going to justify more money to police when it needs to go to health and education?
That's certainly a concern. I agree with you that we're very unlikely to see curfews in quote-unquote normal times, although you do wonder whether that might be something that police would want to use in First Nations communities, particularly remote communities, as a semi-military measure of control. I think the more immediate concern is that we in the broadest sense, progressive people around any issue, are going to have to win back the very limited right to protest that we already have. There was already something of an arm wrestle with the police about when people could protest, how, where, and for how long. And the pandemic has certainly made that much, much more difficult. It's interesting that all sorts of rights are considered, the rights of businesses to remain open, but not the right to protest. I think that's where we're probably most likely to face the challenge. Is that how you would see it as well?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, David. I mean, we've seen huge struggles over the right to protest, which frankly was always precarious before COVID and a site of struggle and antagonism. And that's been only amplified during COVID. And we saw the police taking a really deliberate strategic choice, you know, with the kind of multiple Supreme Court challenges to try and stop the Black Lives Matter protests and other protests across all the states, but it was, you know, fairly heightened in Sydney. And that was deliberate and strategic. So the police and the state decided to make protest a battleground during COVID. And some of the tactics that police have used, not just on the ground, like they've always used paramilitary tactics in policing like kettling and whatnot, but we saw that being justified in a COVID context around allegedly kind of the militarized language and strategies of containment that have always characterized protest policing get deployed to legitimately justify those strategies in terms of containing COVID. And then we saw all of the really fierce legal strategies that police were using, not just to stop the protest, but then, you know, taking protesters to court or protesters challenging fines and going, well, we're going to challenge this in court. Like these really quite novel ways that police prosecutions were playing themselves out, like really quite fanciful kind of ideas around a common purpose, which is, you know, normally used, you know, when the police are trying to, you know, argue that people have been involved in a riot or a fray. So we definitely have seen these amped up strategies around trying to stop protests. And I think absolutely I would agree that after COVID, those strategies will continue to be in play, and you know, it's hard to say normalized because I think that we've always been living in a continuity of a paramilitary approach to policing, but they've had the opportunity to test out a number of tactical and legal strategies during COVID that I think we'll continue to see after the crisis has abated.
Well, thank you, Vicky, for your time. I know you're very busy. I really appreciate you talking to us today.
Thanks, David. It's been a pleasure.
My second guest today is Cooper Forsyth. So welcome, Cooper.
Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned earlier, you were involved in organising a car convoy. Can you tell us what was involved? Who helped make it happen? What were you demanding? And how did the police respond?
The context was coming out of having been stood down from work, and a lot of workers facing the same thing, this massive attack on people's incomes, many people unable to access the disaster payment, but also, you know, the lack of rights for workers being directly responsible for the spread of the virus through the workplace clusters in southwest Sydney, you know, the lack of protection of workers being a massive issue driving the pandemic, as well as, yeah, leading to the threat of eviction, people not being able to pay their rent, going into debt to their family. These are the sort of things that some of my colleagues were going through and that people across Sydney were going through. So we organised a car convoy protest in response to that alongside the Australian Unemployed Workers Union, which, you know, was the idea was we would be being completely COVID safe. Everyone would be wearing masks. No one driving in any car that has anyone other than members of their household to drive past Liberal Party headquarters, because we felt that action was necessary, that we couldn't withhold action even in the current circumstances. But the police very opportunistically reacted completely disproportionately to the protest. People are going to drive to Bunnings and drive to get their Gucci clothes, but driving past Liberal headquarters was met with police blocking off the main streets that we were planning on driving through, with, you know, hundreds of cops, mobile drug testing vans, a kind of insane sort of mobilization of police force. They came to my house, to both my parents' house and my house, as well as other organizers, to try and persuade us to call off the protest. And they fined 9 people for, you know, having slogans written on their cars as they drove through the city.
Yeah, it's a terrible story, very similar to how the Victorian police reacted to a refugee car convoy last year. Same thing, COVID safe. What were the specific demands? What do you think workers need right now?
Some of the key things we were raising were extending the disaster payment to make sure everybody is eligible, first of all, but also to raise the other welfare payments. Unlike last time where we saw JobSeeker doubled along with youth allowance and so on, those things haven't been touched. And so people are just forced into destitution. We got 350,000 now people under the poverty line because they refused to raise the welfare payments. We had other demands such as a test and isolate payment, which, you know, the government has actually just introduced a couple of days ago, which just shows, you know, we were raising that weeks ago. The virus is now completely out of control. If they had bonded to our demands then, we would have been in a much better position. So, yeah, some of those things, as well as, you know, vaccine leave as well, which is still a crucial issue that hasn't been addressed.
All of those are crucial. And the test and isolate payment, I'm speaking from Melbourne, from Victoria. Apparently, there have been 500,000 claims of that payment in Victoria, and yet New South Wales has only brought in that payment just now, and I think from memory $130 less than the Victorian payment. It almost seems like a calculated insult to anybody who is in that situation. What are you seeing in terms of how the police are operating on the streets? And in fact, given that they're using helicopters from the skies, what have you seen more broadly, and what are people telling you?
Yeah, I guess in some ways, you know, anecdotally, like it's sort of completely insane, the sort of police response that we see now with them checking on people's doors, going around to people sitting in parks. And I think it's just sort of in line with the general approach that the government has taken to the pandemic, where, you know, despite the blatant failures over still over aged care, still over workplaces that are not safe, where people have had to stop work, you know, dozens of times, lack of accessibility to the vaccine, and many, many other things, they have just deliberately used it to deflect blame onto individuals and onto migrants in Western Sydney and said, you know, it's ordinary people to blame. And so that has given the police, you know, massively emboldened the police in ways that completely have nothing to do with enforcing the health in a way that's consistent with where the virus is actually spreading. Police response is concentrated on the most vulnerable sections of society.
As we speak, New South Wales has reported 633 new COVID cases, which is pretty scary. It's pretty clear that things are going to get worse before, or even if they get better. What do you think workers need to be fighting for right now to survive this pandemic?
I think one thing that's really clear is that workers need rights to be able to enforce safety in workplaces. We've seen dozens of stoppages at different workplaces that were necessary to enforce COVID measures. Still a key way the virus is spreading, as essential workers have no choice but to, you know, keep us fed and clothed during this time. But also, you know, the rampant casualization that we've seen over the last few decades makes workers extremely vulnerable to having to choose between economic necessity and the risk of getting the virus, which is completely unacceptable if we're going to get this under control. Like, we've already seen people who've actually died in their homes despite their whole family having symptoms because they feared risking coming forward because they didn't want to lose their income. So that's a really critical issue.
Some on the left seem to think lockdowns, the stricter the better, are the way out of this mess. That seems a very weak argument when you consider that the lockdown in New South Wales has been broadly as severe as the lockdown in Victoria last year, yet the numbers are going up pretty much day on day. What do you think about that argument that lockdowns, strict lockdowns, are the way out?
I think there's lots of problems with simply cheering on the government to enforce stricter and stricter lockdowns as the way to get out of the crisis, which is clear that's the method they've taken and has allowed them to paper over the massive fault lines that are actually spreading the virus, which obviously, as long as they remain unaddressed, will not deal with things. But I even think on the logic that they use of we need people to follow the health advice and the health restrictions and so on and so forth, as if, you know, ordinary people are simply indifferent to measures that will, you know, safeguard the health of all of us. If they want to, that what has been shown, especially with the, you know, over-policing of Western Sydney, is that actually this increases distrust of the health advice, increases distrust of the government, and does not make people more willing to follow measures like social distancing measures and so on and so forth. So it's an incredibly short-term and crude sort of approach that does a lot of harm, not just to businesses, but in terms of the massive attack on workers' livelihoods. And at the end of the day, what needs to be done to get out of the crisis is a massive ramp up of the health response, you know, mass testing. If they were sending, instead of sending the police and army, you're sending health professionals to go door to door explaining the health advice to people in culturally sensitive ways and so on and so forth, you know, a mobilization of actually the health system instead of getting a call and getting harassed by cops every single day, instead having been checked up on systematically by New South Wales Health and having things explained to you. I think, you know, those are some of the key things that need to be dealt with if we're going to get the virus under control.
Have you had a chance to be vaccinated yet?
I've had my first dose of AstraZeneca.
Well done. But the reason I ask is that a lot of people haven't had access to vaccination. What's it like amongst your friends and your workmates?
There is a lot of fear, but I think the level of fear has been massively overstated. And the thing that I've seen most overwhelmingly is people's willingness to get the vaccine, knowing the potential side effects and risk and all the rest of it. That's been quite overwhelming over the people that I've seen, because people want to get out of lockdown. They want to deal with the pandemic.
The ACTU and many unions are calling for very useful things like paid vaccination leave, but there seems to be a really big gap between what the unions are saying and what's happening on the ground, with the honourable exception of, as you say, a number of workplaces, particularly covered by your union, the United Workers Union, where there have been health and safety stoppages over PPE and working conditions and the like. What do we need to do to bridge the gap between good policies and actual outcomes?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the key question, really, because I think we've seen, while lobbying and the petitions that have been put forward by the unions have, you know, not gone astray completely and have resulted in some limited gains around the test and isolate payment and so on, I think the situation is way too dire. People can't go 8 weeks, what it's going to be months and months, of not having adequate income. It's just completely unsustainable, and the union should be acting with that urgency in mind. I guess, you know, the car convoy was one example of the sort of things that we could do, with the idea being we need to bring the unions together over practical action, using our power as workers, coming together to take collective action. Where possible, there need to be stoppages, there need to be strikes, you know, to enforce health measures. But I also think it shouldn't be limited to that as well. The union movement should be consciously targeting the government for its inadequate pandemic response and are demanding things that, you know, affect all workers, like raising the payments, like, you know, including provisions that allow people to get vaccinated and have the sick leave they need. And for that, there needs to be a genuine fight across different workplaces, rather than just, you know, being limited to online sort of petitions and lobbying behind the scenes.
Okay, Cooper, thanks very much for your time, and keep up the fight.
Thanks very much for having me.